Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Classic FM. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, country, rock, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from the websites interlude.hk and onthisday.com. Question number one, which composer died after getting cholera from drinking unboiled water? Was that A, Johann Sebastian Bach? Was that B, Aaron Copland? Was that C, Claude Debussy? Or was it D, Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky? So which one of these composers died of cholera anyway? And question number two, what happened on this day to inspire Buddy Holly to write this rock and roll hit song?
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Well,
was it A, astronauts landing on the moon? Was it B, JFK's assassination? Was it C, the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba? Or was it D, the John Wayne movie, The Searchers? What was the inspiration for Buddy Holly to write this tune anyway? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Today's transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of May 31st. Well, it was 57 years ago today, 1967, that Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was released by the Beatles. This was the band's eighth album, and it became known as the soundtrack to The Summer of Love. 1967, today. And it was on this very day, back in 1857, that composer Sir Edward Elgar was born. Elgar was known for such compositions as this. Sound familiar? It's the Pomp and Circumstance March, commonly heard on campuses at this time of the year. So congratulations to all those graduates and families of graduates out there. Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 introduces our classical music news. Locks of Beethoven's hair offer new clues to the mystery of his deafness. Using powerful technology, scientists found staggering amounts of lead and other toxic substances in the composer's hair that may have come from wine or other sources. This article is written by Gina Colata in the NewYorkTimes.com on the 6th of May, 2024. At 7 p.m. on May 7, 1824, Ludwig van Beethoven, then 53, strode onto the stage of a magnificent theater in Vienna to help conduct the world premiere of his Ninth Symphony, the last he would ever complete. That performance, whose 200th anniversary is on Tuesday, was unforgettable in many ways, but it was marked by an incident at the start of the second movement that revealed to the audience of about 1,800 people how deaf the revered composer had become. Ted Albrecht, a professor emeritus of musicology at Kent State University in Ohio and author of a recent book on the Ninth Symphony, described the scene. The movement began with loud kettle drums, and the crowd cheered wildly. But Beethoven was oblivious to the applause and his music. He stood with his back to the audience, beating time. At that moment, a soloist grasped his sleeve and turned him around to see the raucous adulation he could not hear. It was one more humiliation for a composer who had been mortified by his deafness since he had begun to lose his hearing in his 20s. But why had he gone deaf? After 200 years, a discovery of toxic substances in locks of the composer's hair may finally solve the mystery. This particular story began a few years ago when researchers realized that DNA analysis had advanced enough to justify an examination of hair said to have been clipped from Beethoven's head by anguished fans as he lay dying. William Meredith, founder director of the Ira F. Brilliant Center for Beethoven Studies at San Jose State University, began searching for locks at auctions and in museums. Eventually, he and his colleagues ended up with five locks that were confirmed by a DNA analysis to have come from the composer's head. Kevin Brown, an Australian businessman with a passion for Beethoven, owned three of the locks and wanted to honor Beethoven's request in 1802 that when he died, doctors might attempt to figure out why he had been so ill. Mr. Brown sent two locks to a specialized lab at the Mayo Clinic that has the equipment and expertise to test for heavy metals. The result was stunning. One of Beethoven's locks had 258 micrograms of lead per gram of hair, and the other had 380 micrograms. A normal level in hair is less than 4 micrograms of lead per gram. It definitely shows Beethoven was exposed to high concentrations of lead, Dr. Genato said. These are the highest value in hair I've ever seen, he added. We get samples from around the world, and these values are an order of magnitude higher. Beethoven's hair also had arsenic levels 13 times what is normal, and mercury levels that were 4 times the normal amount, but the high amounts of lead in particular could have caused many of his ailments. He had enough lead in his systems to, at the very least, explain his deafness and illness as. No one is suggesting the composer was deliberately poisoned, but Jerome Nieuwegein, an expert on lead poisoning in history and a professor emeritus at the University of Michigan, said that lead had been used in wines and food in 19th century Europe, as well as in medicines and ointments. One likely source of Beethoven's high levels of lead was cheap wine. Lead, in the form of lead acetate, also called lead sugar, has a sweet taste. In Beethoven's time, it was often added to poor quality wine to make it taste better. Wine has also fermented in kettles soldered with lead, which would leach out as the wine aged, and corks on wine bottles were pre-soaked in lead salt to improve the seal. Beethoven drank copious amounts of wine, about a bottle a day, and later in his life even more, believing it was good for his health, and also because he had become addicted to it. In the last few days before his death at age 56 in 1827, his friends gave him wine by the spoonful. His publishers even gave him a gift of 12 bottles of wine, but by then Beethoven knew he could never drink them. He whispered his last recorded words, "Pity, pity, too late." For a composer, deafness had been perhaps the worst affliction. At age 30, 26 years before his death, Beethoven wrote, "For almost 2 years I have ceased to attend any social functions just because I find it impossible to say to people, I am deaf. If I had any other profession, I might be able to cope with my infirmity, but in my profession, it is a terrible handicap. And if my enemies, of whom I have a fair number, were to hear about it, what would they say?" When he was 32, Beethoven mourned that he could not hear a flute or a shepherd singing, which, he wrote, "brought me them almost to despair. A little more, and I would have committed suicide. Only art held me back. Ah, it seemed unthinkable to leave the world until I had brought forth all that I feel lies within me." His Ninth Symphony was most likely a way to reconcile his grief with his art. Since he was a teenager, Beethoven had been enthralled by a poem, Ode to Joy, by Friedrich Schiller. He set the poem to music in the Ninth, sung by soloists and a chorus, considered the first instance of singing in the symphony. It was the culmination of the symphony, depicting a search for joy. "The first movement is a depiction of despair," Beethoven wrote. "The second movement, with its loud kettle drums, is an attempt to break through the despair. The third reveals a tender world where despair is set aside," Beethoven wrote. "But setting aside despair was not enough," he concluded. "Instead, one must search for something that calls us to life. That finale, the fourth movement, was that calling. It was the Ode to Joy." In the years since Beethoven's Ninth, the song still playing in the background, has deeply moved millions. Even Helen Keller, who heard, quote-unquote, it by pressing her hand against a radio. "As I listened with darkness and melody, shadow and sound filling all the room, I could not help remembering that the great composer who poured forth such a flood of sweetness into the world was deaf like myself. I marveled at the power of his quenchless spirit by which out of his pain he wrought such joy for others. And there I sat, feeling with my hand the magnificent symphony which broke like a sea upon the silent shores of his soul and mine." Bobby Freeman's Do You Want to Dance introduces our music research and technology. It's titled Why Some Songs Make Everyone Want to Dance. A syncopated rhythm may prompt our brain to find the beat. This is written by Anna von Hopfengarten in Scientific American on the 26th of March, 2024. Experts have gained deeper insight into why people spontaneously dance to music. New research suggests the impulse to bop to the beat, what some scientists call the groove experience, depends on the music degree of syncopation, a feature that affects how predictable the rhythm is. The work reveals why we cannot resist moving in sync with the beat when we listen to music with an optimal level of syncopation, says Benoit Bardi, a movement science researcher at the University of Montpellier in France. Bardi, who was not involved in the new study, describes it as a very innovative piece of science. Syncopations are rhythmic patterns in which accented or unaccented beats in a melody appear in surprising places relative to the standard beat. The more syncopation a piece of music contains, the less accurately you can guess the rhythm of the next few bars as you listen. In a series of experiments, cognitive neuroscientist Benjamin Morillon of France's Aix-Marseille University and his team examined how syncopation relates to the groove experience. In one test, they played 12 different melodies, but the melody's rhythmic shifts varied so that each tune was played with 3 different degrees of syncopation. Participants then rated how much they wanted to dance to each track. A medium degree of syncopation triggered a strong desire to move to the music. In contrast, neither very high nor low degrees of syncopation had that same result. In other words, people didn't particularly want to dance to an entirely predictable rhythm or a highly surprising one. In addition, the groove experience seems to be all about finding the music's underlying pulse, the study shows. This suggests that with a moderate level of syncopation, our brain can still extract the periodic beat from the melodies. The brain is essentially trying to anticipate upcoming beats amid a melody syncopation. The result is the impulse to dance. For a long time, music and dance have been studied separately in the brain. Much research to date has focused on either auditory perception in music or motor production in dance, and this study takes a step towards bridging the gap between the two. The complexity of coordinating and integrating brain areas may help elucidate why some people have impaired rhythmic movement. Morillon, meanwhile, explains that a key motivator for his work is understanding how people make sense of time and how the motor system helps us recognize temporal patterns and anticipate future events. What I find fascinating is our lack of a dedicated sense of time, he says. We have specialized systems for processing sound and light, but time perception remains elusive.
Let you leave without a trace. When I stand here taking every breath with you, ooh, you're the only one who really knew me at all.
Phil Collins, Take a Look at Me Now, introduces our rock and pop music news. It's titled Immediate Family Film Highlights Unsung Musicians Behind Hits of the 70s and 80s. This is written by George Panaccio, ABC 7, December 22nd, 2023, Los Angeles. The new documentary, Immediate Family, introduces us to the talented stars behind the stars in the music world. We meet 4 session musicians who in the 1970s and 80s played on some of the era's most well-known albums. But it goes beyond just that time in music. These guys, now in their mid-70s, are all still playing today. The film celebrates their success while giving us quite a history lesson along the way. This documentary comes from director Denny Tedesco, who highlighted session players of the 1960s with his first documentary, The Wrecking Crew. I want to be able to share these stories with people before these stories are gone and lost, said Tedesco. Those stories go along with the songs, Tedesco says. Every song is a bookmark in someone's life. And now those bookmarks go back for generations. It used to be, oh, I love that song. We used to play it in high school. Then it became, oh, I love that song. My parents played that song all the time, or that album. Now it's, oh, I love that song. My grandparents played that album. Playing on more than 2,000 albums was Leland Sklar. It's been a great run, and for me, the real fun part of all this has really been the variety of being able to work with, you know, playing It's Raining Men one day, and then working with Barbara Streisand the next, and then James Taylor the next, Sklar said. That's really what kept the juices flowing in us, is the variety. It's exciting every day still, and for the musicians in this documentary, it was exciting back then too. Artists like James Taylor, Carole King, Phil Collins, and Stevie Nicks, to name a few. It really does bring people together. Music is something that we all have in common around the world, Tedesco says. Sklar says he is flattered by all this attention, and it has changed things. I guess so. I can't go to the supermarket anymore. This multi-award-winning doc, Immediate Family, is now available on video on demand. I had been hesitant to make a follow-up to The Wrecking Crew, but when I was approached with the idea of The Immediate Family, I didn't think twice. Danny Tedesco, director. So, how'd you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, which composer died after getting cholera from drinking unboiled water? Was it A, Johann Sebastian Bach? Was it B, Aaron Copland? Was it D, Claude Debussy? Or D, Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky? Correct answer? Answer D, Tchaikovsky. As noted in a 325-24 article in interlude.hk, Tchaikovsky was feeling uncharacteristically optimistic after writing and performing in October 1893 his famous Sixth Symphony, also known as the Pathétique. However, his life was cut short just a few days later when he went to a restaurant and drank a glass of unboiled water. There was a cholera outbreak in St. Petersburg at the time. Tchaikovsky came down with the disease and, after an illness of just a few days' duration, died. Rumors have circulated that his death was suicide or, quote-unquote, forced suicide. The New Grove Dictionary of Music concludes, however, we do not know how Tchaikovsky died, and we may never find out. And the answer to our second question, what happened on this day to inspire Buddy Holly to write his rock and roll song, That'll Be the Day? Was it A, astronauts landing on the moon, B, JFK's assassination, C, the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, or D, the John Wayne movie, The Searchers? And the correct answer is, once again, answer D. Buddy Holly had just seen the John Wayne movie, The Searchers, and became inspired to write the classic hit, That'll Be the Day. As noted in a 925-17 article titled, The Inspiration for Buddy Holly's That Will Be the Day, published in mprnews.org on September 25, 2017, in 1956, Buddy Holly and his drummer, Jerry Allison, went to see a movie in his hometown of Lubbock, Texas. They saw The Searcher, starring John Wayne. Wayne had a response that he used throughout the movie when someone said something he didn't agree with. That'll be the day. As legend has it, after the movie, Holly looked at Allison and said that it sure would be nice if they could record a hit song, and Jerry replied, "That'll be the day." And that was the inspiration for the song by Buddy Holly and the Crickets that went to number one on the Billboard pop chart 67 years ago today. So in recognition of the anniversary of the so-called introductory song to the Summer of Love, 1967, let's close out today's program with the Beatles album that was released 57 years ago on this very day. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program's also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. So long. Until next time.